Welcome to Misfits Theology Podcast, where together we're learning to question our faith in order to cultivate a deeper trust in God. Enjoy.
So this is the Misfits Theology Podcast, and our man on the show today is Clint Hardesty. Can you tell them a little bit about yourself, Clint?
Well, I'm currently the director of campus ministry at St. Thomas More University Parish here in Norman, Oklahoma. I've been doing that for a whole year and 2 months, 3 months now, something like that. Definitely not where I expected to be at this point in my life. I had worked at OU for about 10 years after I got out of the Army, and through some circumstances we can talk about later, I ended up at St. Thomas More. So
sweet. Clint and I actually know each other, for those who may not know us, through a mutual friend, Chris Thrutchley, who we will actually be interviewing at one point for this podcast series. So, so Clint, why don't you just start off telling us about your journey, how you came to faith, how you deconstructed that faith, and how you reconstructed it, and kind of end with where you're at now. And as we kind of have this conversation, we'll, if I have a question, I'll ask it, and we'll just kind of wrap up from there.
Okay, man, sounds good. Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess it kind of goes without saying, right, that I feel like I'm constantly in this kind of state of deconstructing and reconstructing and then deconstructing again, you know. I guess, yeah, the older I get, the more, I guess, at peace I get with that kind of idea, you know, that probably never going to feel fully at home in any one particular kind of tradition or whatever, but I think part of the deconstructing and reconstructing is, of course, like learning to live in peace with that, right? That's kind of what the impression that I've gotten since, you know, kind of being introduced to that idea, at least as it's kind of referred to by the deconstructionists and Pete Rollins and Rob Bell and folks like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, grew up here in Oklahoma, kind of a nominal Protestant Christian upbringing, you know, vacation Bible school here and there, church somewhat regularly until I was about six. My parents split up, and then we kind of stopped going to church as much, except on holidays. My sister and brother-in-law would take me. They were very active in a kind of a Pentecostal church called Full Gospel Assembly. It was kind of the height of that 80s kind of Keith Green, you know, really like very musical, so speaking in tongues, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of great people. But it wasn't really till I, and like most, you know, like a lot of kids, you know, prayed the sinner's prayer a lot. Usually like whenever I would go to I remember one time I went to the state fair here in Oklahoma, and I managed to get a hold of like some Chick Tracks.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and so I remember, you know, taking those home and reading those and then, you know, saying the prayer, you know, not wanting to go to hell or whatever, and feeling like, oh, not wondering if it took, you know, and but I kind of did that until I got to college, and college was the first time I'd ever really met anyone that at least as far as my interactions with them, really just really figured out that they were kind of taking this more serious than what I'd been kind of exposed to before, this idea of really following Christ and stuff. And the funny thing is that, as always, you know, my motivations were so pure. I went to my first Bible study purely because I thought it would be a great place to meet a nice girl. And in fact, the girl stopped me on campus and invited me, you know, and she was really cute and everything, and so I'm like, oh yeah, I'd love to go to the Bible study, you know, and of course I went to the first Bible study, and it was all dudes. Like, she wasn't there, there were absolutely no girls there, right? But
I feel like that's a little deceitful.
yeah, well, these guys were, like I said, they were the first guys that I first, you know, that you know, they read their Bibles every day, and they just seemed serious about what they were doing, and that was attractive to me at the time. I was a collegiate, you know, athlete, and it was really just beginning to see that that wasn't, I mean, I was enjoying it, but at the same time, I guess, there I was looking for more, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And that sense of purpose that these people had really attracted me a lot. And so anyway, so that's kind of how I, you know, had my first, like, real, you know, religious experience, or I wouldn't say first real one, but, you know, like, as a person, you know, able to kind of think about some things, kind of when I first started getting involved. And I got involved at University of Kansas. I got involved with Campus Crusade for Christ and did that. And I stopped playing baseball. I moved back to Oklahoma to finish school. And I got more involved with Campus Crusade here at OU, and eventually came on staff with Campus Crusade, got married, came on staff with Campus Crusade, and worked with them for a couple of years at the University of Massachusetts. And it was really at University of Massachusetts where I really started kind of, I mean, I guess there'd always been kind of some restlessness, but had a gentleman up there that gave me a book called Reading the Scripture with the Church Fathers.
Wow.
And, yeah, he was a Protestant, you know, and the book was written by a Protestant. And I had never really, I had kind of a little bit of an interest in Catholicism, thought it was kind of attractive, you know, and as you know, the high church stuff was kind of interesting, the liturgy and the stuff like that. But the thing that really got me is I was always really interested in hermeneutics and biblical interpretation. And this book kind of exposed me to the idea that, you know, there was a lot of really interesting interpretation hermeneutics going on before Martin Luther, you know, which that was kind of as far back as I went. And so anyway, I started reading that book, and, you know, over the course of about, you know, five, six years, just through study and interaction with people, eventually decided to become Catholic. And it was challenging, you know, for my wife. She was, you know, we were both kind of from that evangelical background. She had grown up conservative Baptist, which is like Southern Baptist, but in the Northwest, some similarities there. And it was really hard for her. But then eventually she came into the church on her own accord. Like, I didn't try to argue her into it or anything, but...
And you were with Campus Crusades at this point, right, in Massachusetts?
Well, at that point, I had left Campus Crusade, and I was actually in the Army.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So you didn't leave Campus Crusades because you were becoming Catholic, but it was just a different season in life, and you were going into the military?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, I think the thing with, you know, I left staff, one, because I just felt like, honestly, like, I remember coming back from Kazakhstan, and had a really great time, you know, starting a ministry there at one of the campuses in Austin, two of the campuses, actually. And I remember really coming back and being really excited about the kind of relationships we'd started and some of the connections we'd made with people. And I remember certain people in leadership there were just too concerned with, like, flag posting and numbers and stuff like that. And that along with some other things, I was kind of like, I think it might be time for me to get out. Not because necessarily that, I mean, I loved them and I was so indebted to them. It just felt like that was not the kind of environment for me at that time, especially, of course, getting more interested in some of the older church stuff. That probably had something to do with it. And then also just wanting to do something else. You know, I really thought I wanted to be in the CIA at the time. So I joined the Army and, you know, started off in military intelligence and eventually got into special operations and, you know, spent a lot of time in South Korea, did a tour in Iraq, and actually about 8 months prior to my ETS, which is basically when the Army says you're done, about 8 months prior to that, I decided to apply for conscientious objector status. And that was due to, you know, just experiences I had with the war and prior to the war, and some studying I was doing with actually a Hindu teacher in North Carolina, and along with some of the reading I was doing, Thomas Merton, Dorothy yeah. Day, Thich Nhat Hanh. So
and that correct me if I'm wrong. The movie Hacksaw Ridge, based off the book and the real life story of Desmond, that is essentially what he did while he was in the army as well. Is that correct?
Well, it's a little different because, you know, he came in kind of knowing, from what I remember from that story, he came in knowing that he objected to, you know, fighting with weapons or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, I did not. It wasn't until after I was in, and I remember a friend of mine who was also becoming Catholic at the time, I remember the time it was just about the time the war was starting in 2003, and he was spouting off stuff by, you know, Chomsky and stuff like that, and I had never read anything by Chomsky, and I was like, oh, of course our government would never do anything that wasn't totally good and just, you know, I mean, I was just really naive at the time, and started reading a lot of things that were critical about U.S. foreign policy, Chomsky for one. Of course, Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States, and read a lot of other stuff. And that kind of started me, that kind of, you know, critical look at American foreign policy led to some of the spiritual teachings, like by, you know, Thomas Merton, Thich Nhat Hanh, Father Daniel Berrigan, you know, and that kind of evolved into this more holistic, not just a political opposition, but a spiritual opposition. Yeah.
Could you maybe, I know some of our listeners might not know what conscious objector is. Could you maybe define that for us a little bit and maybe define this? It sounds like you were coming into a more, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you were coming more into a pacifistic understanding of the faith and of war.
Well, the conscious objector is you're not necessarily a pacifist.
Okay.
It's basically you object to war in all of its forms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I personally am not a pacifist. You know, I would use physical force, like to defend myself, to defend my family, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I am totally and completely opposed to modern warfare, you know, in just about any shape or form.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty clear that modern war is, you know, pretty horrendous, and the toll that it takes on civilians and you know, innocent bystanders is really just inexcusable.
Yeah.
You know, rather than participate in that, you know, I would rather myself, you know, die or, you know, be imprisoned or whatever. But fortunately, in fact, the United States Army, if you apply for conscious objector status and you do it the right way, it's a status that legally they totally allow for, right?
Yeah.
It's a very rigorous process to get approved, you know, and they check. I mean, it's very, very difficult, especially during wartime, to get approved. They do a really rigorous job, psychological analysis, lots of interviews, you know, questioning, all kinds of boards and things like that. Because, of course, anytime, you know, when you're at war, you get people that are just doing it to get out of, you know,
yeah,
fighting, whatever. But
And if you pass, you don't have to fight. Is that correct?
Right. And the funny thing is that, you know, I was in Iraq working in special operations, and I'd been there maybe 4 months. And, you know, had wrestled with the, it's such a long story, I don't want to, you know, bore your listeners with the whole story, but, you know, I had been there and I had been wrestling with this the whole time, even while I was there in Iraq, you know, running these missions and stuff. And we went on one particular mission, and the things that I saw on that mission just horrified me to a degree. When I came back from that mission, I was like, I can't go on. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And so I actually, at that time, you know, I'm in the middle of, you know, I'm in Iraq, am on this three-man team. We're far away from our headquarters. I began writing, you know, my statement, which I didn't really even know what that was. You know, I began writing kind of, you know, things down, and I ended up calling my friend from North Carolina, who was kind of my spiritual advisor at the time, and he is a man who's he's more of a, his background is more, you know, in Hindu and Eastern spirituality, and began to talk about him, and he's the one that kind of told me about this conscience objector status. So fortunately, at that time, I was, you know, starting to write stuff down in my journal, and then I actually was flown back to our headquarters. We were out on the Syrian border. That's where we were. We flew back. I was flown back to go to a promotion board. Actually, I was going to get try for promotion and get promoted and stuff. And I went to this there, and that's where I started, had access to a computer that I could use, and I started writing my, you know, my letter, and I remember would walk like 2 miles to use the phone at this like place, and I would call Tom, and or I'd write him, and would look up stuff, and eventually, you know, put together my application in the course of about 5 days when I was there back at, you know, kind of was supposed to be, you know, doing this board and getting some rest time. And so yeah, I wrote it, did all my research, you know, got my references, you know, people that, you know, I thought would kind of would, you know, be references for kind of my journey or whatever. And then the day I was supposed to go back out to the Syrian border, you know, when I walked out to leave, my commanding officer and or the senior NCOIC were there, and I just handed them my letter and said, I'm not going back. So,
wow.
Yeah. So then, so they read it, you know, and of course they're legally required to start the process. And so anyway, all that to say, I was in Iraq. They ended up moving me from the border to a place, our headquarters. And so I went from kind of working out in the field and running missions to working in like a headquarters environment. Although we were still, you know, under mortar fire. And in fact, I was probably, you know, mortar when I was at the headquarters there, mortar landed about 30 feet from my, you know, where I was sleeping.
Wow.
So it was still pretty hairy, you know. And, but anyway, so I've completed my tour in Iraq and eventually went back to the United States, and I got my conscience objector approval literally the day after I completed my actual term in the Army.
Wow.
So I completed my term, the term that I had signed up for, and got my conscience objector status the day after I got out. And the thing is like, you know, I remember a guy asked me in Iraq, when I was going to do the psychiatric evaluation, a sergeant, he asked me, you know, you've got 6 months left on your contract. Why are you doing this now? Why are you, you know? And I said, well, if you woke up tomorrow and realized that what you were doing went totally against everything you believe about God, about humanity, would you wait 6 months to stop doing that thing, or would you try to stop doing it right now?
Yeah.
And so, anyway. So, yeah, so that's that story.
Yeah, so
I got lots of stories, man. It's you're gonna have to do some serious editing.
That's okay. But so I just want to clarify for myself and for our listeners. So you had come to the conclusion, not that total pacifism in the sense of, you know, that any sort of violence was wrong. Let's say, you know, someone comes into your home and you defend yourself. Right. That wasn't what you'd come to the conclusion of that was wrong, but war was more of what you were coming to the conclusion of was not how you were supposed to live as a follower of Jesus. Is that more correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because I am, you know, I like a good fight. You know,
yeah.
I studied Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for many years, you know, did a little boxing, and so, I mean, it's kind of a, I guess in some ways, you could either call it hypocrisy or I'm a paradox, you know, but I like mixing it up a little bit, but again, just from the reading and contemplation that I did and also what I experienced, like war, modern warfare, I can't in good conscience participate in that. Even if I wasn't, you know, and even at the time, you know, I was investigating other spiritualities, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems, even just to say that it's opposed to the teachings of Christ seems like just a small, it just seems opposed to everything that we are supposed to be about as humans on this planet.
Yeah.
Right. And so it was, it just seemed like the most, you know, logical, rational, and, you know, spiritual thing I could do at the time. And there's a lot of things that go into a decision like this, right? Like, I'm not going to say that, you know, my motivations were completely, you know, pure, and because I had serious, you know, issues with American foreign policy, right? Yeah. It wasn't just the spiritual stuff, you know, is our foreign policy, American imperialism. I mean, I was really, really, and I had serious, serious issues with the way I saw the war being run from where I was, right?
Yeah.
You know, from my immediate supervisors, not all of them, but some of them, my immediate supervisors to some of the higher ranking, you know, officials and, you know, leaders that I saw in Iraq, I was like, this is bullshit. You know, like there was just, so it wasn't just, you know, like, you know, it certainly wasn't, you know, I was no Desmond. There was not this like totally pure, like religious kind of, you know, it was definitely a combination of a lot of things.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like deconstruction in and of itself, whether it's, you know, it found in your story or in anybody's story, it doesn't just come from typically from one direction, but there's multiple facets that are going on in your life that raise these questions that begin this deconstruction process. So, yeah, so it would totally make sense that it wasn't just one thing that was kind of leading to this conscious objector, but it was multiple facets of your life going on at the moment. So,
and it's funny that you mentioned that with the, because there is this, I think the more that I, you know, and I'll just speak for myself, you know, like I noticed that over the course of my life, I would have a tendency to kind of frame my story in a certain way. You know, if I was talking about my conversion, you know, it was like, it was kind of putting it in the light of, here's, you know, I'm really seeking the truth, you know, like I'm reading and I'm studying and I'm really wanting to follow Jesus in the most, you know, purest way or whatever, you know, and then I look on it and I realize, no, there were a lot of other motivations there, you know. Yeah. Some of it was the, you know, seeking novelty, right? Some of it was seeking, thinking that this new thing would energize your faith in a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, some of it is the mystique, the mystery. Some of it is my own personal desire to rebel, right?
Yeah.
Like I have authority issues, you know? And so everything like from my conversion to Catholicism, from my, you know, conscious objector. I mean, I think as we, you know, as I get older and have more experience, like being willing to just say, to kind of look at my motivations for things and be real and honest with myself, and then start trying to be more honest with other people about, rather than always kind of, you know, presenting myself as the hero of the story. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the noble, you know, this, like it's all some noble pursuit of truth or whatever. And is that, I don't know if that makes sense at all, but
yeah, I think so. It doesn't make any sense, I think, not to be honest about our motivations for anything, you know, let alone our journey of faith and our deconstruction and reconstruction of that faith. And so we have to be honest, and sometimes, you know, we may end up in a good place because of those things, but the things that may have gotten us to that good place may have not been the best, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say maybe come back to transition from how your time in the Army and coming back, how your deconstruction continued.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, like, at the time, I'd spent a lot of time in Korea, and for some reason, you know, when I was there, I've just always been a reader and just curious about things, you know, and I started reading all kinds of stuff, whether it was stuff about Buddhism, you know, because landing in Korea and for the, you know, I'd lived in Russia and lived in Kazakhstan, but this was my first time in the Far East where, you know, the culture is, you know, from the inside out, it's like a Buddhist culture, right? Whereas Russia and Kazakhstan, yeah, you know, with the Soviet Union and the kind of forced, you know, state-sponsored atheism or whatever had a tremendous impact, it was still, it felt very much at its core, you know, it felt Christian. Does that make, you know?
Yeah.
But man, South Korea was at its core. It felt so alien spiritually, yeah, right?
There's a different cultural worldview there than in Kazakhstan and in Korea.
Right. And I would even say, like, you know, worldview doesn't even do it justice. You know, it was almost palpable, right, yeah, for me. And I remember feeling that. And at first it was kind of frightening, but then it really sparked this kind of curiosity in me. And it also, I remember thinking very specifically, like, you know, how can I possibly think that these, you know, millions of people are in complete error, right, in how they see the world and how they see spirituality and how they see God. I mean, that is such an arrogant, felt like such an arrogant thing for me to think at the time that I somehow knew something that all of these people, you know, did not know. And so I began to just kind of talk to people and kind of get to know them, and I began to read, of course, and it was, that was kind of the beginning of some real questioning and some real opening up. And as with anything at first, it's kind of, you know, it's discombobulating, but it's a really wonderful time, a wonderful beginning of a journey, and a wonderful journey. And then, you know, getting out of the Army and going back to grad school, kind of continuing that questioning of a certain way of seeing my faith, right? A certain way of seeing Jesus Christ, a certain way of seeing Christianity. And grad school, I really immersed myself in the writings of Nietzsche, Foucault. Foucault and Nietzsche specifically were two thinkers that really were interesting to me and I gravitated towards. I also, you know, I was always a huge, huge Dostoevsky fan and read a lot of Dostoevsky at the time. And he, of course, his perspective is quite different, you know, in a lot of regards than Nietzsche or, you know, Foucault. I wouldn't lump him into that.
Yeah,
but
he was Eastern Orthodox, wasn't he?
Yeah, very devout man. But at the same time, you know, you've got Dostoevsky, who, in my opinion, wrote the absolute strongest argument against the Christian faith ever written in his chapters, The Grand Inquisitor and Rebellion in The Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah, I have that book on my shelf right now. Yeah,
that is the strongest, you know, argument against, you know, theism, against Christian faith ever written. And yet Dostoevsky himself was a very devout, you know, man. But he was, you could tell he had wrestled with things in a very real way. And he was probably the first thinker and writer that made me feel not alone and kind of how I, you know, was questioning things and seeing things.
Yeah.
So you know, just kind of continue, you know, read, you know, I was getting my second master's degree and I was studying phenomenology and philosophical hermeneutics in with Dr. Eric Kramer here at OU, and reading a lot of cool stuff, really, you know, all kinds of really neat stuff. But then I remember the first time I read After Virtue by Alistair MacIntyre had a tremendous impact on me, because there was a guy who I could see had kind of had some similar experiences intellectually. I mean, not like theoretically, let's say that, intellectually, you know, not even close, not even, shouldn't even mention his name, you know, in the same sentence with mine, but, you know, theoretically had some kind of, you know, he had made a journey from, you know, atheism, agnosticism, Marxism, you know, and there was some things like that in my past, you know, this kind of, you know, radical, you know, when I got out of the army, there was this very radical leftist kind of, you know, neo-Marxist kind of thing going on. And then, you know, reading After Virtue and, you know, learning about how he kind of saw, you know, Christianity and particularly, you know, Thomistic philosophy as kind of a, you know, centering kind of I don't know if best is the way to put it, but the best framework for understanding the world or whatever. So so that was kind of the beginning of a, you know, of a move kind of back into orthodoxy, you know, to some degree, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, then it was, you know, I've never been good at church. You know, I've never been really good at wanting to go to church, you know.
Yeah.
But I've always found that I've always felt like Catholicism for me worked because it's a big tent. You know, there's a lot of room in there to question things. There's a lot of different communities, you know, that, a lot of different flavors, I guess you could say. But you know, I kind of did that for a while, but it wasn't really the thing to this point in my life. I would have to say, you know, the most defining occurrence in regards to just my life and certainly my view of God and spirituality is the death of my youngest son, Ransom.
Mm.
I mean, I was, you know, up to that point for me that everything had been, I would say, primarily intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
As you can, I did a lot of reading, a lot of thinking, and this makes sense, this doesn't make sense, and, you know, this, you know, going from, you know, like, okay, the Christian worldview, despite its flaws, despite, you know, whatever, it's the most rational way to look at the universe, right? Like,
yeah.
It answers the most questions in the most satisfactory ways for me. And this is after, you know, studying Buddhism and some other Eastern religions. But with Ransom and my experiences with Ransom, both during his, you know, the last year of his life and after his death, like, that's the first time God became, I would say, real to me in an experiential way.
Yeah.
What I moved from, you know, from a guy who, if someone came to me and said, oh, I had a dream last night and my dead grandmother came to me and it felt so real and blah, 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 and she really spoke to me and this and that. You know, if you would have come up to me and told me that story prior to my experiences with my son Ransom, I would have said to you, oh, that's really neat, you know, cool, whatever. But in my head, I would have been like picking it apart and coming up with explanations as to why it happened psychologically and blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And since my experiences, you know, I'm much more open to, I would say, the fact that God interacts with us in ways that cannot be fully understood and fully explained, and yet they are more real to me than anything I've experienced. And, you know, when looking at someone from the outside who's gone through a loss like that, right? the loss of a, you know, when you're young, losing a parent, or, you know, a parent losing a child, you know, there's always this kind of, I always kind of like, well, of course that person is going to believe in God now, you know, because they've lost the child, and they can't imagine a universe, a world where that child is no longer in existence, or that parent is no longer in existence, right? So they have a psychological motivation for belief. So I can't trust them, you know, I can't trust that as being like a rational belief.
Yeah.
And so, you know, after Ransom died, of course there is this, the idea that his soul is extinguished forever, right? That light is extinguished forever is a very hard thing, very difficult thing to come to grips with. And yet, there was a point where I was at peace with that idea, at peace with the idea of my own kind of extinction, right? The extinction of my spirit. And it was really interesting, you know, that kind of being able to, I guess, resign myself to that, to be at peace with that, you know, was an experience that I never really felt like I would have, you know, that this is it, there is no God, you know, that kind of thing. Like, and I guess I realized that, you know, it made me realize that, you know, my choices, I could choose to be an atheist or an agnostic, or, you know, an atheist, and that would be there's a peace there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, you know, after having gone through that, beginning to kind of reconstruct, you know, a faith that incorporated these experiences I had, these things that I had seen in Ransom, you know, the last couple months of his life and after his death, and incorporating these moments of that, you know, whether in contemplation or whether just walking down the street, that felt transcendent, right? That seemed to be transcendent, incorporating them into my faith in a way that I never did, you know, before it was pretty primarily intellectual, you know?
Yeah. Would you say, I'm just trying to kind of wrap my head around, your story and particularly the part of your son Ransom dying. Would you say at his death that there was a choice you had to make from either holding on to your faith and incorporating these experiences that you had in the last couple months of his life, or the choice of atheism or agnosticism? Would you say that's a fair statement?
Well, I think for me, you know, the atheism was, you know, in some ways it was more of an intellectual exercise. Mm-hmm. Like, can I come at this and be okay with it?
Yeah.
You know, the choice was really more about moving into a real relationship with the divine. And
rather than it just being an intellectual exercise.
Rather than being an intellectual exercise or a social exercise or a, you know, and with that, yeah, and the funny thing is that's what contributes for me, at least, is this constant state of, for lack of a better descriptor, deconstruction, reconstruction. I feel like I'm constantly in the process of reevaluating things I believe and what I understand to be true and what may be true and the limits of my own perspective, you know, and much more open to experience, much more open to hearing what other people have to say, less trying to be less judgmental about, you know, what they say about things. I mean, it's that experience, again, it's, you know, I could talk about it for 6 hours. I mean, the way that it's, you know, it's probably best if you ask some questions about it.
Yeah. So, what were some of those experiences that led to kind of shifting the focus of your faith from being an intellectual exercise and about God and maybe a social exercise to having your faith be more orientated around an experiential relationship with the divine and maybe with others?
I think that, you know, I remember one time, you know, this was near the end, and Ransom was really weak, you know, and this is a kid who, he was our youngest, but he was the most rambunctious, the strongest of the kids. He was the one that I always kind of imagined would kind of take care of the older boys. Like, he was just a real force of nature, and tough and aggressive, and yet really sweet and kind. And, you know, to see him go from that to, you know, not being able to really do anything and becoming extremely thin, it was, you know, I mean, I can't even describe, you know, what it was like. And yet there was a moment where, and I don't know that, I can't say it in words that would communicate what it was, but there was a moment when I was in Ransom's room and Amy and I were kind of trading off, you know, changing shifts. And I remember she was holding him in her arms and I was looking down on him, and it was, the best way I can think about describing it is, the transfiguration in the Bible. There was something about him, looking at him at the time, you know, seeing it and feeling it, it was like, it was so otherworldly. You know, there was something about him and his presence there that, you know, it, like I said, it was, I imagine that in some ways that's what the transfiguration was like to see. You know, and again, these kind of things, I can't really put it into words, it's hard. I can't imagine there being a bridge to understanding for someone that hasn't experienced something like that.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, you know, with someone that's dying or maybe even just having a moment, you know, while you're sitting in the woods or something, someone who's never had that, you know, like, there seems like there's no way to bridge that gap between, you know, what that can be like. But for me, it certainly bridged that gap. Experiencing that. So, that was one moment that changed. And there were other little things too, but.
Yeah. I mean, you were talking about, you know, kind of this, maybe for lack of a better word, or maybe this is the term we should use, this mystical experience with your son. It reminded me of, there's a woman that's part of my church. Her name is Vicky. She's alluded to it, but I don't think I've ever heard her tell the story itself, but her coming to faith was through a mystical experience. And I have had, I guess, a couple, if you want to call them mystical experiences, prophetic visions or dreams myself. And I was trying to explain one of these experiences to her, and we were talking about her own experience a bit, and what she said to me was, you can't put these experiences to words. There's not enough words to explain them and make sense of them. Even for yourself, even if you yourself has gone through this experience, you just can't put words to it, let alone someone else trying to explain it. So,
you can't even explain it to yourself.
Yeah.
I can only know that it's, like, there in me.
Yeah.
I can't even explain it. That's really good. I would like to meet this woman and talk with her sometime. Like,
yeah, absolutely. I told her about the podcast actually last night. So, hopefully she'll listen to it and maybe she'll reach out to you.
Well, and I think for the purposes of kind of the podcast too, I think the part, you know, this part is as far as, you know, versus all the talk about my becoming Catholic or, you know, like the conscious objector stuff. Like, for me, you know, this really is the has my experience with Ransom has been the defining kind of moment, you know. And the other, for me, as a, you know, as a spiritual person, as someone who's totally enamored with the person of Jesus Christ and interested in Jesus Christ and trying to follow Jesus Christ, right? Another thing, not so much a mystical experience, although I guess it could have been one, was, you know, about a year after Ransom had passed, I was walking to my job at OU. At that time, I was working as an academic advisor in the College of Engineering. I'd been there about 5 years, and, you know, I liked my job. I was really good at it. You know, I was really good at saying all the things that I needed to say, helping students, you know, who kind of lost their way, or encouraging students, because, you know, engineering, mechanical engineering and all the engineering fields are incredibly challenging, and people end up in those fields for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, I remember, so I'm walking to work, right, and I had, at that point, I had left the PhD program. I'd finished, you know, about maybe 2-3 classes towards my PhD, and was thinking, like, what is the big thing that I'm supposed to do with my life? Like, what does God want me to do with my life? You know, because I'm so, you know, talented and smart, and surely there's something really big and important that I'm supposed to be doing, versus instead of, you know, not just being an academic counselor, right? You know, like, surely there's something. I'm like, am I supposed to go back and finish my PhD? You know, blah, 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 blah. And thinking about all these kind of things as I'm walking, and then it's as if a voice spoke to me in my head, right? And it could have been the voice of God, if you think that God, you know, curses, right? Because the voice said, why don't you just try to be a decent fucking human being? Like, that was the phrase, right?
Yeah.
That came to my head at the time. And it blew me away. You know, I went to work that day, right?
Yeah.
And instead of, like, I really tried to, like, instead of just saying the right things and being good at, you know, directing people, I began to really try to, like, enter into, you know, be empathetic with people, like the people I was counseling, right? And, like, really listen to them, right? Not just listen to them to pick out the little points so I could make sure and give them good advice, or what classes to take, or who to go see if they want to change their major, but really try to enter into, like, a relationship with them, right? And yeah, love them, and, like, really care for them, you know, and give a shit about, like, what happens to them in a real way. And that changed my life, dude. Like, that, it changed my entire perspective, you know. And I, of course, just, you know, as a, just an idiotic, you know, narcissistic, selfish, like, person, you know, I still, like, struggle with, you know, ideas of, you know, whatever, you know, the going from total insecurity to total overconfidence and arrogance or whatever. But it has changed the way, like, I interact with people, and has helped me become just, I think, a much more, just a better person. Like, yeah. Of course, you know, I wouldn't necessarily compare myself to other people, but, like, compared to the person I was, you know,
yeah,
it really had a tremendous, it just changed everything. So, and, you know, that experience, I wouldn't have been open in that way had it not been for what my experiences with Ransom and what God was doing with those experiences, right?
Yeah.
Because that's all stuff I knew before. Who doesn't know that that's what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to be a good person. Like, that's the basic thing, you know, like, love your neighbor as yourself. Everybody knows that, right? You know, you don't have to, like, go to conferences and, you know, lead Bible studies and be in Bible studies or whatever, all these, you know, have a PhD to know that you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself, right?
Yeah, it's pretty simple.
But for, you know, someone like me, you know, who, like, it's just all those things that I said, like, it took those things for God to break through, right, into my life and bring that very simple, basic truth home to me, you know. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny how again, speaking for, I just how stubborn and closed I can be. But,
this kind of makes me think, you know, I think oftentimes for us to be where we need to be, we have to go through deconstruction. You know, for you to be able to realize, not just to know, but to realize and to act upon and to strive with your whole being to be a person that loves their neighbor, and loves God by loving their neighbor, you had to go through these experiences, and you had to go through these things that kind of deconstructed your faith at that time. And I thought about this for myself, that as I've been deconstructing, and I would tend to think I'm more in the reconstruction phase, but I don't, like you said, I don't think deconstruction ever completely ends. But as I've been, have deconstructed so much of my faith, you know, I don't know how to follow Jesus anymore. And
Right.
Yeah.
I can relate to that, man. Yeah.
And not knowing how to follow Jesus anymore, you know, you're put in a position to where God is able to teach you how to do it.
Right. And give you the simple things, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was before, it was always like, surely there's more to it than that, right?
Yeah.
Sure, there's more, and perhaps there is, right? Perhaps there is. But let's just talk about where I'm at or where we're at, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, those, you're finally, like, I think what you're finally freed up to just pursue these very basic things that, while they are simple, are also immeasurably complex, right? That are also incredibly difficult to do, and yet you're finally able to see, right? That,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is this is what he was talking about, right? You know,
yeah.
Like, all this other stuff is just, you know, and I was talking, I was reading a book. I think it was Osho. It was a East Indian mystic and teacher, and, you know, passed away. Well, I'm not totally familiar with his life. I just, a friend of mine recommended some books. He was talking about how, like, basically, you know, the finger points at the stars, right? And we have a tendency to kind of focus on the finger.
Yeah.
Right. We make the finger the stars or the God, the most, and that's kind of how all these other trappings can be for us, or for me, you know, like the Bible studies, the mission trips, and the finger's not bad, like those things aren't bad, right?
Yeah.
But I have a tendency to focus on those things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And not saying that, and of course not saying that other people that are doing those things, that that's what they're focusing on. I know myself well enough to know that those people are probably 20 times better people than I am. Right?
Yeah.
Like, but for me, like, I just have a tendency to just, those become distractions way too easily for me.
Absolutely. I'm thinking of, when you said that, you know, we tend to focus on the finger rather than the star. I remember this experience I had the summer after my sophomore year of college. I was fasting that day, and one of the kids that was doing the internship with me, I happened to be doing that summer, asked me what the Lord had taught me that day. And kind of in that moment, and it's really hard to explain, just kind of what we were talking about earlier. It's hard to explain these mystical experiences. But the Spirit kind of, he manifested himself through me in such a way to where I was asking the question, but it was really him, like, pushing the question out. I can't really explain that well, but...
No, I get it.
Essentially, he asked the question, you know, if you lost everything today, if you lost, you know, the ability to have a wife and a future family, if you lost your spiritual gifts and your calling, if you lost your house and your where you're going to college, if you weren't able to go there anymore, and if you lost the Bible, would I be enough? And long story short, I couldn't answer honestly yes. And a couple weeks later, I felt like the Holy Spirit asked me to ask him what he wanted to tell me, and so I said, well, what do you want to say to me? And the Holy Spirit said, I am enough. And I, what I learned from that experience, and I think what God has built off of that in the last 2 or 3 years since it's happened, is that all the things he listed were good things. But all those things had become idols in my life. All those things had become things that I had focused on too much. And not just me, but those around me at my evangelical college and the churches I was a part of. And so, that's really good stuff. You know, the idea of we tend to focus on the finger rather than the thing the finger is pointing to. I think that's totally true. And if we realize that, I think it would be extremely helpful.
Well, and I'm one of these, I have always really overestimated my spiritual advancement.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm just, you know, like, I'm at the point now, I realize I need to keep it simple, right? And through that, I mean, I've experienced a depth in my relationship with God that I've never experienced before. And it's opened me up to, you know, that's a big part of the music thing too, you know, like, you know, opening myself up to those kind of experiences. Whereas, you know, everything up to a certain point was very intellectual, very, you know, and now there's much more freedom of expression. And, you know, I did lots of things before that, you know, I wrote novels and stuff like that. But it now it's just a different, it's just different. Yeah. You know, much more of a, you know, experiential, and still, you know, there's that framework of the intellect, of course, and the theoretical and all of that. And definitely, you know, it's funny because I didn't, you know, start reading like Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upward, until after I was kind of in the middle of all this. Mm. And it was kind of funny to see parts of my life really tracking the things that he talks about, right?
Yeah.
So, but I still read, you know, but not like I used to, you know?
Yeah.
And not to add things to my, you know, curriculum vitae, you know?
Yeah.
So I can tell people that I've read, you know, all these, you know, the entire, you know, Summa or whatever, you know. So I'd much rather, you know, play music, right? I'd much rather have a conversation with someone, right, about kind of what's going on with them. What are they thinking? What are they feeling, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of reminds me of Jesus. Because Jesus, I mean, he would have these theological debates. And I think those were, Jesus did it. So I think it was good, you know. But that wasn't, I feel like that wasn't his bread and butter. I think his bread and butter was when he was in people's homes, having meals with them, whether it was Pharisees or whether it was the tax collectors or the prostitutes. It was when... Jesus could go all day having these theological debates, but that you missed the point of the theological conversation he was having with those people if you miss the point that the point is to be in homes with one another, having meals together, having fellowship together, living life together, you know, in the kingdom that Christ has proclaimed. So we're coming towards the end of this, but I want to ask a couple of questions. We kind of went all over the place with this, and I think we're both kind of scattered-brained kind of guys, and that's totally fine. But
might be good to, you know, take a listen to what we came up with, and you might have to come back with some questions, and then we can, you know, I can give you some more kind of specific, shorter answers that you could use for your podcast, you know.
For sure. But I did want to ask just a couple questions kind of to be helpful for our listeners and for myself. So when this is going to be a big question, so maybe just pick one or two things, I suppose. But maybe the your early faith compared to your faith now? Not necessarily all the things that have changed in the middle, but maybe between your early faith and your faith where you're at now. What are some things, theological concepts that have changed for you, whether it's your particular view of hell or your view on the Bible or what may it be, like things that you once believed and now you're operating from a different framework? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think the number one, as a person, as a guy who's always been interested in biblical interpretation, my view of the Bible has changed dramatically, right? And yet my love for the Bible is, you know, I'm kind of in a renaissance right now of reading the Bible and wanting to understand the Bible and read, you know, but I, you know, prior to, you know, I was never like a total like biblical literalist, right? Like, yeah. I the idea of like a 7-day creation and the earth being, you know, 10,000 years old or whatever, that always kind of, you know, that never set real well with me. And I never was really in communities that where I felt like I absolutely had to believe that, right?
Yeah.
But even just the idea, you know, for instance, looking at the Old Testament, that, you know, there's some really messed up stuff in the Old Testament. Like, yeah. You know, God ordering the slaughter of all the Canaanite, you know, men, women, and children, and there's some, you know, and the whole Joshua and, the, you know, all the stuff that Joshua did is just, I mean, come on, it's just awful, you know, like, and then also just weird stuff in there, right? And like the story of Jonah, you know, and like understanding what the heck that's supposed to be about. Like, you know, Rob Bell, like, you know, his whole thing on Jonah that he does in his book, you know, What is the Bible? Like, for me, was, I just thought that was beautiful, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We need to, you know, as before, I would have been one of those people that would get lost in the argument about, yes, he really was swallowed by a whale.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
yeah,
like, that happened.
Yeah.
Right? This is not a, you know, but now I can see that as a story of, no, it doesn't really matter whether he was swallowed by a whale or not. What matters is it's a story about God showing love and compassion to the sworn enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
And the hero of the story, the Jewish prophet, being pissed off about that, being mad that God is showing compassion to their sworn enemies. Like, that's what that story about,
yeah,
is about, you know. And so seeing the Bible, not as, even though we'd always talk about, you know, it's the inspired word of God, but it didn't drop down from heaven. It was written for men, but it's still perfect, you know, like, no. It is the expression of human beings who somehow have this relationship with God. It is their, it is the telling of their story of reaching towards God, of their understanding towards God.
Yeah.
Of their understanding of God. It's still...
Oh, go ahead.
It's still inspired.
Yeah.
Still valuable for teaching. You know, it's still all these things that I believed it was, you know, 20 years ago, but it's a much, you know, it's a much different, and it's a much more interesting way of seeing the Bible for me. It's a much more, for lack of a better word, productive,
yeah,
way of seeing the Bible. And, you know, entering into the way that the tradition, the way that Jews have traditionally used the Bible and read the Bible and discussed the Bible and talked about the Bible, so much better than what Western Christians have tended to do, particularly Christians in the last 200-300 years, you know.
Yeah.
So that's certainly changed. The other one I would have to say is definitely, you know, the idea of hell, right?
Yeah.
That's another big one. Hell, and then this idea of when, you know, Jesus says, I am the way and truth and life, no one comes to the Father through me. You know, before it was like, oh, obviously, you know, you've got to be a Christian, you know. If you're going to go to heaven, you got to be a Christian. You got to, you know. Whereas, you know, so hell, the big, you know, I remember listening to a podcast once, and guy had, you know, did the whole Hitler illustration, right? Like, what if you combined, like, the souls of Hitler and Stalin and, you know, all these horrible people into one person, and they went to hell, and they suffered eternal torment, you know, for 10,000 years, for 20,000 years, like 30,000 years, that's probably enough, right? Like, that's enough. There's no need for, like, an eternity there, yeah. Right? Like, I remember thinking, like, yeah, that kind of makes – and so, anyway, just now more of a – and, you know, a lot of this stuff gets found in the writings of the church, you know, like St. Gregory of Nyssa was a universalist, you know.
He was a hardcore universalist.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of strands of this, you know, in Orthodox, you know, teaching and stuff. You know, this idea that, man, we just don't know. We're never even at a point, right, where I know for certain that I'm good to go. You know, we need to constantly be in a state of reevaluating what we're doing in the present moment, right?
Yeah.
And then also too, like understanding that heaven is basically the ability to be living in the present with God. That's heaven.
Yeah.
When you die, it'll either be a continuation of that continual living in the present with God, or it will be the continuation of whatever other journey you're on, right?
Yeah.
But I do believe that that God will eventually bring all things to Himself. Yeah. You know.
So you've come to a universalist Christian universalist understanding.
I mean, I definitely don't know. You know, don't know, but you know, like most, I'm a hopeful universalist, right?
And yeah. That's actually what Chris Strachley says.
I'm a hopeful universalist, and it doesn't seem, and I certainly, you know, I am not ready to say that people who are not Christians are going to hell.
Yeah.
That is, again, and just speaking very frankly right now, that idea is absurd to me.
Yeah.
It is patently absurd. I don't really care what anyone says, you just can't say that.
There's definitely other ways to think about it. That even the church, you know, different ways that the church has understood what hell has meant. And I think that if I'm wrong in this, you can correct me if you know otherwise, but our current understanding of hell in, you know, 21st century America is actually an idea of that developed in the Middle Ages, you know, European Middle Ages.
Right.
Yeah. And so we tend to read that back on to some of the New Testament texts.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. And, you know, the David Bentley Hart's The New Testament, if you haven't had a chance to read that.
I haven't.
It's so great. But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see, like, oh, yeah, that's... He's not talking about hell the way I conceive of hell.
Yeah.
Jesus isn't talking about heaven the way I conceive of heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, John 17:3, Jesus defines eternal life not as, you know, floating in the clouds forever and ever, but he defines it as knowing God.
Right.
Which is different, and it starts now. It's not something that, you know, starts, you know, after God destroys the earth and all that.
Right. Yeah, totally. And so it's funny, you know, and again, a lot, you know, trying to read the scriptures first and foremost, like, you know, who was Jesus talking to? What was he talking about?
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I'm not a strict originalist, you know, like that it has to mean that, that, and only that, but it needs to mean that.
Yeah.
At least, you know, to begin, we can't just throw that out and be like, no, he's talking about a medieval conception of hell that he didn't know about.
Yeah.
Right? So
there's a great book I think that you would like, and I think maybe some of our listeners might like. It's called, I'm reading it right now, it's called How to Read the Bible, A Guide to Scripture Then and Now. It's by James L. Kugel, who's a Harvard Orthodox Jewish scholar.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Basically in the book, he's going through the biblical stories and the biblical narrative of the Hebrew Bible, and he's comparing the modern historical critical interpretation of those texts, essentially what they meant in their original context by their original author to their original audience, and then the ancient interpretations that people in the post-exilic period created around these texts. So he compares the essentially the original context of that particular biblical passage, and then the interpretive ancient interpretation of that practice by early Jews and early Christians. And he's trying to essentially not get rid of one or the other, but how can we reconcile these both of these ways of interpreting the Bible? So I think that would be
you need to send me that, a link to that, because I would definitely. Yeah, it's funny, you know, one of the things that the movie Noah, did you ever see that?
I did. I actually liked it, and I liked the message behind it.
I love that movie. Yeah. I'm a big Aronofsky fan, but, you know, when I read some interviews about him and kind of, you know, basically it's the Midrash in a film. You know, the Midrash is, my understanding, it's basically, you know, the traditional Jewish way, you know, reading the scriptures is like, you know, you look at the story of Noah in the Bible, it's pretty bare bones. There's not a lot to it, right? And so what the kind of traditionally what Jewish people would do would go back and kind of fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And add things and, you know, and extrapolate things. And that's kind of what Aronofsky did with Noah, you know, and, you know, put that on the screen. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's so much more illuminating and interesting than just what's in the Bible, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we have, you know, we're not drawing like doctrine from it, right?
Yeah.
But it's a practice that's meant to elevate our spirits and our minds, as you know. So anyway, but yeah, it made me think of that for some reason you're talking about that. But,
as you can tell I've
come to where I'm at now by some very complex theological reading, you know, like watching the movie Noah and hearing voices, you know, as I walk to work and stuff. So
yeah, and that's actually the time that, you know, the Second Temple period of Israel, as well as the early church, that was when the methods of interpretation that developed during that time are what continued and became Midrash. And it's something like that. You would want to read it just to fact check me on that. But from my understanding, that's basically where Midrash came from, is these, out of these creative interpretive practices that were already developing in the Second Temple period and on into even the early Christian period. And we, you know, a lot of people might get upset about the movie Noah and even you mentioning that it's a Midrashic interpretation of that story. Some people might get upset, but what people would realize if they understood and they begin to look at into the ancient interpretive practices of not only Israel, but also the early church, they would realize that a lot of their interpretations are actually these ancient interpretations that actually have nothing to do with the original context. And that's actually one of the things that James Kugel talks about in that book. So, but hey, it was great having you on. If I have any other questions, I'll get to you, and would love to have you come back on the show sometime and maybe talk about something else. But
I'd love that. So
cool.
Maybe next time I'll have a book that I can, like, you know, like a book that I've written that I can, like, kind of plug, because that's what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to have, like, right now all I have is like music websites and check out my music, but I'll have a book for you next time that I've written that I can be like, okay, yeah, check out my book. This is my book. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, if you want, go ahead and tell our listeners, if they want to connect with maybe some of the music that you're doing right now, where they can do that.
Well, you can find my, you know, I have a Facebook page. It's just Clint Hardesty. That's all my solo stuff. You can follow me on Instagram, Clint Hardesty. But the thing that I'm really excited about right now is a 2-piece thing that I'm doing, a band called The Cake Eaters. And I guess, you know, to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of what it's like, it's kind of in the vein of like Black Keys, White Stripes kind of stuff, but it's a different type of music. It's definitely, we're excited about the kind of innovativeness of it. It's a lot of reinterpretations of some old Delta Mississippi Hill Country slide guitar in a more kind of garage band rock kind of thing with two piece. So, but yeah, check that out. We're doing a lot of stuff, playing festivals and playing in Norman and OKC, and plans to do some touring this spring and summer. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I me and Hannah, my wife, we went to one of Clint's. He was playing at a bar in Norman, Oklahoma, and so we went and checked out. And I absolutely, and I'm completely illiterate when it comes to the genre of music. So everything he just said went completely over my head. But I listened to him play that night, and I really liked it. So I think Clint has he's not just talented in deconstructing and reconstructing his faith, but he's got a lot of musical talent too. So you guys check that out if you're interested.
Cool, man. Well, thanks again for having me, man. And I just want to say, you know, just the short time that we've known each other, you know, like, and particularly like the book recommendations and some of the podcasts that you've recommended to me, you know, and people can, you know, check those out on the Misfits page, you know, those podcasts and those books, like, tremendously valuable into me and really helping, like, kind of the things that I've been going through, you know, to kind of like, oh, okay, that's, you know, they're going through that. This is how to understand that. This is how to talk about that. And all of those books and those podcasts have just, I mean, there's really just no way that my experiences would have been illuminated in the way that they have been had it not been for the recommendations that you made, you know, regarding those books and those podcasts and stuff. So definitely thank you for that, and definitely encourage, you know, your listeners to check out those resources, because they're outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that. And, I never thought recommending a couple books that would be so impactful and meaningful to you. So thankful for that. And what, Clint's referring to is on the Misfits Theology, website, and we'll have that in the show notes. We're trying to build a list of different reading recommendations and blogs and podcasts that you guys can go to maybe connect with people that have had similar experiences to yourself going through deconstruction and reconstruction, and that's just supposed to be a helpful resource for everyone. So thanks for pointing that out, Clinton. Again, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah.